playing the bell. Okay, so welcome back. This will probably be the last week that I make this ridiculous plea, which is if you are not registered, please make sure to see Lisa Draper, who's standing right there, so that she can help you get registered. Okay? Because it is what empowers this flex. A quick announcement. Bree, where are you? And let me give you this so you don't have to...
About this far away.
Oh, good, because my voice is not very loud. I thought I just wanted to put your attention to something that's happening tomorrow at the Center of the Heart, because we were touching on mystical spiritual experiences and getting faced like that. There's a healing arts fair tomorrow at the Center of the Heart, where there are several psychic people, spiritual people. They do like readings of all kinds, like 15-minute bites. You can get a taste of whatever interests you. My husband and I, we are doing some incarnational intuitive reads. The offline is over there. I thought it's just, I just thought I'd say that somebody's in here who wants to get some bites.
Thank you.
So that's at the Center of the Heart tomorrow, Healing Arts Fair. David, would you turn that thing off? No, I think you need to. It's going to be interfering.
I have an announcement.
You?
Every week after class, a few of us get together and meet at a coffee house called David Ryan, two blocks away, at Mission in De La Vina. And we discuss, we connect, we share, we digest, and just keep the consciousness flowing after class. So everyone is invited. That's after class, the Daily Grind, De La Vina, the Mission. Hope to see you there.
Looks like we're kind of settled down a little bit.
Peter has one. Peter has one?
Yeah, Bob.
Again.
I'm not sure. We're going to do that next week.
Okay. Oh, not next week?
Yeah, that announcement's going to happen next week. Okay, so let's talk a little about mindfulness, and then we'll sit for 10 minutes as we generally do, and then I'll introduce our guest for the morning. So, last week, I talked about the fact that when you practice mindfulness, oh, by the way, you can do anything you want in this 10-minute sitting, and you don't need to practice mindfulness, it's just a suggestion. Just use the 10 minutes in any way that helps you be more focused, more clear, more calm, more deep. But if you're doing mindfulness, what I talked about last week is the fact that after a little while, not when you first sit, it's just mush. And finding your breathing is difficult, and you don't stay with your breathing for more than a fraction of a second, and then you're off somewhere else in your mind. But when you keep coming back to your breathing, just come back to your breathing over and over again, let yourself soften and open, at some point, things start to clarify. And when they start to clarify, you begin to track your thoughts going through your head, words and pictures, your feelings as they move through your body, sensations as they happen within your body and coming from around you. And these things appear in front of you. It's as though you're taking a step back, and your viewpoint is now interior to these things which were formerly who you were. So looking at this diagram, this is the usual you. And then when you come back to your breathing over and over again, after a little while, you're here looking at this stuff. What is this stuff? This stuff is your personality and your body, the things we usually identify as who we are. Now we're an awareness of these things. We realize we're more accurately, authentically, deeply, an awareness in which these patterns occur. So that's what I said last week, and that's obvious to everybody here pretty much. The question is, what is your attitude when you're here toward what's here? I guess, ideally, if you were totally enlightened, you would have no attitude. It would just be stuff that you were registering. However, because we're not totally enlightened, and we have certain identification with these things, we have certain attitudes that we have toward ourselves. If you have the attitude from here about these things that you have here about yourself, you're likely to make these things worse. That is the conditional love that you have for yourself that you learned when you were little that caused all the perturbations and contractions and difficulties here. If you keep giving yourself that attitude, you will worsen those patterns. That is, if you say to yourself, God, listen to my thoughts, what a jerk I am. Or listen, look at my feelings, God, I'm so depressive. Or, oh, my body, oh, it's just falling apart. You know, if you keep, if from here, looking at these things, you do to these things what was done to you when you were young to develop these attitudes, then these attitudes will increase. So what attitude should you have, and should is a terrible word to use, but I'll use it, what attitude should you have toward the self that you walk around in? This is like your clothes, right? This is like who you really are underneath your clothes. What attitude should you have towards your clothes? Now you know that your shirt is outrageous looking and your pants are too tight and your shoes are falling apart. So you realize from here that there are some things about your personality and body that aren't ideal. What attitude should you have? It was a rhetorical question. Let me answer so the attitude that I suggest is the attitude of a good parent. The attitude of a good parent, which is a loving, accepting attitude. And occasionally a suggestion for enhancement or correction. But not an attitude of conditional love. That's bad. Get rid of that. I wish that weren't there. Rather an attitude of, kid, I see how much you worry. I see how upset you get. I see how, and it's okay. It's okay. I acknowledge that that's who I am at present. Those are the patterns that I have learned. Those are the patterns I'm carrying through my life. Those patterns all have use. They enabled you to survive. So they, at least at that level, they should be honored because they worked. But maybe they don't work so well now. You know, maybe that shirt needs to get changed. Maybe those pants need to get mended. Maybe those shoes need to get thrown out and repaired, you know. But at this point, you are who you are, and the best way to help your thoughts, your feelings, and your body heal is to give those things the unconditional love and acceptance that they should have had at the beginning. So what you do is you just bow to it. Jack Kornfield says, you bow to everything that comes to you. You bow to your worries, you bow to your heartbreak, you bow to your pain. You know, you just go, well, you know, it's there. The best I can do is accept it and give it love. So it's really like you hold yourself in your own arms. It's like your own mother. And you have this embracing consciousness, this embracing awareness in which these patterns that you learn, which may not be terribly functional now, can be experienced, can be accepted, and can open spontaneously. They can heal because they're in an atmosphere of love and acceptance, not an atmosphere of criticism. So this is really an experience when you're mindful of realizing aspects of who you are and loving yourself as you are, such that who you are feels more loved and less needing to continually adopt these constricting, defending attitudes. So breathe, soften and open, notice whatever's happening, and give it a little love and acceptance. But sit, let's sit.
Let's sit for 10 minutes and then we shall, I'll ring the bell in 10 minutes. Chalquist.com. It's amazing. It really is great. It's filled with a wonderful stuff, but we'll talk about all or some of that. But I encourage you to go to Chalquist.com and WorldRead.com if you want to read some profound and remarkable things. So, by way of introduction, I'm going to not do justice to Craig's curriculum, to Craig's CV, okay? But just read some highlights from what he has done.
and then a little bit from his website, and then I will start asking him questions, and then you can also ask him questions, and we'll just kind of get as much from him as the time permits. Okay? So Craig is currently Associate Provost at Pacifica Graduate Institute. Okay? Prior to this, from 2012 to 2017, he was Department Chair of East-West Psychology at California Institute of Integral Studies, that many of you know about. Okay? He taught echo psychology, planetary psychology, archetypal mythology, and a doctorate seminar on Jung's Red Book, Gnosticism, and other topics. Prior to being a full professor at CIIS, he was core faculty and acting department chair at John F. Kennedy University. Since 2005, he has taught more than 40 different courses, graduate and undergraduate, created and taught 26 new courses in psychology, mythology, research, and eco-psychology. He is the founding editor-in-chief of the journal Immanence, the Journal of Applied Psychology, Legend, and Folktale. When I followed the link and went to Amazon, I think I counted 11 books currently available. Is that accurate?
Ten
books currently available. So he must do something with his spare time. But he certainly doesn't have much. So those are a few of the highlights of his CV. I'll read just a tiny bit from his website and then we'll just start. So from childquest.com, my interests include storytelling, folklore and myth, depth psychology, symbol and dream, Terra psychology and presence of place, eco-psychology, where self and world meet, enchantivism and deep systemic change. And I'll ask you about that in a minute. I especially enjoy exploring what mythic motifs, plots, and images might be alive in specific events. I'm going to read it again. I especially enjoy exploring what mythic motifs, plots, and images may be alive in specific events. Myth is hardly dead. It is going on all the time, inside and outside of us. Every time we perceive how and why, more of our lived, felt reality is re-enchanted. So I guess my first question, Craig, to you, and then we have to
do a
fancy dance with the microphones. I have to turn mine off, he turns his on, and because we can't have them both on at the same time. So my first question to you is, you're going to be teaching something in the spring here, yeah? So what is that, and would you explain a little about it if it happens to be a chance?
Before I do that, can you all hear it, actually?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to thank Spencer both for that very gracious introduction, but also for inviting me here. And I want to mention that in addition to just being happy to be here, being here is getting me out of several administrative meetings at my school. So I'm really, really happy to be here. I'm going to be teaching something on enchantivism here. And a number of us got together, I guess it was about 3 years ago at Pacifica, and we were talking about how for the most part, when we begin to talk about how to change things in a positive way, when we read the news and we feel distressed, or we think about injustices and things just going wrong in general, a number of us were saying, where are the positive visions for where we might go? Where are the images of the kinds of community we might actually have fun living in? It's, for the most part, the discussion is about what we're against, and I understand that that part's necessary to some extent, but no visions of where we could be. And somebody like me doesn't get motivated only by what we're against. I like to know what we're for, and throughout my whole life, the punishment threat model, as Virginia Satir, the family therapist, would put it, never really worked well with me. I would just get stubborn and quiet, and I had to train my parents not to do that. And then when they started in the other direction of reward, then I did a lot better. So that generalized over the years into, what is it that inspires? What is it that, and I use that word a lot in chants. The word literally means to be inside a song, to be inside a chant. What song do we want to be inside of? So we'll look at that. And as part of the Enchantivism course, we'll talk about what are the stories that we can tell that lead to a sense of enchantment. Stories that are big enough so that they don't ignore the things that are going wrong, but they're spacious enough to include what's going right, or what might go right, or where we want to go. And so I'm a huge believer in the power of fantasy and visioning and storytelling, and I can talk more about that as we go if you want. So as part of that course, we'll also practice some storytelling skills too. So that in short is what we'll do.
So I'm gonna broadcast so we don't need to go back.
Okay.
So can you give us an example of what a positive story might be given something that we're currently facing?
This one goes back a few years, but it still applies to the current climate as well, especially in this country. So how many people watched a lot of Star Trek?
Yay!
Hello! You're all here. I did too. And when that show first got going, the creator of it, Gene Roddenberry, was very firm. We want to have people of color on the bridge. They show us where we're headed, right? And white people and everybody. We want diversity on the bridge of the Enterprise, right? So he had to threaten to not proceed with producing the show to get his way in Hollywood, and they caved in. So Lieutenant Uhura showed up, Michelle Nichols, the actor, showed up. But because of the way production of shows goes, she got very small parts at first. So it was hailing frequencies open, hailing frequencies closed, right? And she didn't like that. Who would? So she complained about it, and finally said, you know, I think I'm going to quit Star Trek. I think I'm just going to leave the show. There's other things I can be doing. And she had I don't know if you know anything about her, she's got an enormous range of talent. Singing, storytelling, dancing, I mean, just all kinds of things that involve humanities and the arts. So she got intercepted on the way out by somebody who will probably all recognize, Martin Luther King Jr. And he said, please don't quit. We watch this show every week. And part of the reason we watch it is we want to see that we are included in the future. Black people are included in the future. So there were episodes of Star Trek that dealt more explicitly with issues of race and less explicitly with issues of race. But the very presence of somebody on the bridge in that way is what I think of as an exemplary example of enchantivism. Not simply making the argument or doing a protest or what have you, but just showing people what that could look like. And that's what I love about the power of stories. You just show people. It pulls people instead of pushing them all the time. So that would be one of many examples. Actually, can I mention one more contemporary? So there's someone named Jacqueline Susskind who lives in Northern California, and she's one of those poets who puts up a little stand. I don't know if she still does this actually, but anyway, a few years ago, she would put up a stand somewhere, and people would walk up and say, could you write a poem for such and such an occasion? And then she would do that. And so a guy walked up and he said, you know, my wife just died and I would really like a poem. And so she wrote this really moving poem for him. And he loved it so much, he asked her for more poems. So they struck up a sort of informal friendship. Now, they both realized, kind of to their mutual surprise, that Jacqueline Susskind is an environmental activist. And this was surprising because the guy who was coming to her for the poems was an executive level officer of a company that was about to log down trees that she was trying to protect. So we had conversations about this. But for me, the important point, and I'm not in any way saying anything negative about activism, that's not what I mean by this, but what strikes me about this is that it wasn't protest or politics or anything like that that saved those trees. It was an informal conversation between two human beings getting to know each other. So the last I heard, he was living on, I don't know if any of you know the word permaculture. It has to do with growing food the way nature does. You know, putting plants together, for instance, the way nature does. And so he was getting trained in that by her. She's a permaculture expert. And doing a number of other things. So there was, I think on both sides, not just his side, but on both sides, there was a transformation of consciousness about the situation and their role in it. But it took place at the inspiration of a poem. So that would be another example.
At some point, will you also teach eco-psychology, and if so, what is that, and how does that relate?
Yeah. I'd like to. I think we talked about that. I'm not sure if it's actually in the spring, but at some point I hope to. That'd be great. So that goes back to about mid-1990s, and up in the San Francisco Bay Area, there was a group of psychologists who were also educators who got together, again, an informal conversation. That's where the real business happens, right? Again, official meetings are good for business as usual, but if you want to get things done, do it unofficially and things will get done. So in the same way, some educators who were psychologists got together with a number of environmental activists and an ecologist or two and other people that care about nature. And the question they gathered to talk about was, why is it that psychology and ecology are not on speaking terms? Is it not obvious that we are ecological beings, that we're connected to nature, that we are nature, we're nature speaking and thinking and feeling? And so why is it that our mainstream psychology says nothing about this? And so out of that came a kind of discipline movement field called eco-psychology. And a chief premise of eco-psychology is that psychological health depends in part on the health of our surroundings. We can't meaningfully separate them. So if we want to be psychologically healthy, both on a personal level, but also on the level of culture and nation and so on, then we need to make sure that our surroundings are healthy too. So that's a primary working assumption of eco-psychology. And since then, there's been practice and ideas and research and more books and all kinds of things that have been generated out of that discussion. So including an application of eco-psychology called eco-therapy, which is a set of techniques for actually getting back in touch with the natural world, and that don't require us to go hiking in the backcountry for a month or go on a vision quest, although those are good things to do. But eco-therapy techniques could be used by anybody. So that's part of it too. And we would, if I do end up teaching that here, we'll practice some of them. They're easy to do.
So that's where I was going to go next, is to ecotherapy. Do you think that part of the problem with the way that we're not terribly happy as a culture and a world has to do with the fact that we are somewhat isolated and insulated from nature, that our lifestyle has changed such that there's always stuff over our head and around us? I mean, is that having a real effect?
Yeah, the research says so, and a lot of therapy says so, and other things do too. I actually have a specific example about this in my work. at least for some people. But when I was training as a psychotherapist, I'm now a full-time educator, so I don't have time to see people, but my training originally was in psychotherapy and family systems. And during my training, we have to be in therapy ourselves, which is a really good idea. So at some part of my therapy, I began to get depressed, and I had a really good therapist, and she said, "You look depressed." I went, "Yeah." Maybe it sounds simpler than it really was. And she said, "Why don't you go on psychotropic medication? I'll refer you to a good psychiatrist." And so I said, "Okay." And I didn't really want to be on medication, but it made sense. And by depressed, I don't mean that I was sad. I mean that I was flat. I didn't feel anything, including joy. To an increasing extent, which is a kind of hell when you're in it, you know. So, saw the psychiatrist, got put on antidepressants. They work pretty well. I'm not in any way like an anti-medication advocate or anything like that. I think in some cases they can be overprescribed, but in other cases they seem to be necessary. And they did well for me for about a year and a half. But then, I don't remember why, but I got interested in gardening. And part of that, I think, came from my dad, who was an incredible gardener with no certification or training. He would look at plants and they would grow and be happy. And I never got that way, but I got interested in it and I wanted to learn more about gardening. And so there was a woman I did a trade with where she said, "I'm getting too old to do a lot of composting and weeding and all this heavy stuff, so if you can handle that, I would teach you how to garden." And I went, "Great, I'd love to do that." So I would hang out in her yard on the weekends, and I liked her for a lot of reasons. One was she was super knowledgeable about gardening, but she would also address the plants as persons. So she'd come in, we'd go into the garden early in the morning, and she'd say, "How is everybody?" And so she would tell me, I'd put my gloves on to do things, and she'd say, "You know, unless you're afraid of cutting your hands up, try gardening without gloves." And I went, "Okay." So I did, and I had my hands in the soil, and I got really happy. And so after a while, I went off the psychotropics. And one of the reasons I'm mentioning this, and I haven't been on it since, by the way, that was a long time ago. I'm mentioning this not in any way to blame my therapist, who was pretty much trained the way I was trained. We did exactly what we're trained to do, and inside that particular therapeutic worldview, you know, which doesn't take nature into account very well. So I don't in any way intend this that way, but what an ecotherapist might have done would be asked questions like, "How much time do you actually spend outside, if ever?" And at that time I was a busy student, I was working full time, I was married at that time, so I was looking after a family and all the rest of it, and the answer would have been hardly ever go outside. An ecotherapist might have said, "How much actual contact do you have with plants and animals? Is there any nature in your home? What's your schedule like? Because that's part of nature too, right? Do you always have to use an alarm clock to get up, or do you get up with the sun, which I now do? In fact, I get up before the sun does." Questions like that, how do you spend your free time, and so on and so forth. You know anything about the nature and the seasons and the weather and the place where you're living? So my therapist didn't ask any of those questions. I didn't ask any of those questions when I started doing therapy, but they made a huge difference. And so we now know that for at least some of us, if we just increase our nature contact by a little bit, it can not only alleviate depression, it can lower anxiety, it can do wonders for your blood pressure. When people suffer from dementia, even having a window or an aquarium nearby or whatever helps them cope with them a little bit better. There's all kinds of findings about this, on and on and on. And so, to a less extent in this country, but in places like England, they're onto this. And so there's a lot of really good research coming out of Sussex, especially. And doctors in Great Britain are sometimes emailing people like me and saying, "Do you know any doctors out in their neck of the woods in the UK who do ecotherapy, because we'd rather do that than always prescribe drugs, you know. We will prescribe if we need to, but sometimes you don't. And so, one last thing I'll mention about that. There's a soil bacteria that's been under study for several years. And it can, they studied it in animals first, and I think now they're starting to study it in us. And it boosts serotonin levels, and so it's good for your brain, in other words. And so an experiment you can do yourself to see if there's any validity to that piece is, if you're feeling kind of flat or just down, if you pick up a handful of fresh soil and hold it for 20 minutes, it's supposed to take about 20 minutes to actually affect your brain chemistry and bring your mood up a bit. So just try it and see if that has any effect. So antidepressants in the soil.
Can you know their name of that bacteria?
Mycobacteria baccae. M-Y-C-O bacteria. B-A-C-C-A-E.
B-A-T.
T as in David.
Yes, in bacteria.
So I'll say it again, yeah. So one letter at a time. M Y C O B A C T E R I A. Mycobacteria. And then the second word back, I B as in Victor, A C C A E. One of many substances and chemicals and all and forms of life in the soil that have a good effect on it. There's others too. So.
I still want to stay on ecotherapy for a little bit, and there's two directions I want to go with it. Do you think that, there's probably not a lot of research for this, but what is your guess? If we took people who were schizophrenic, for example, and we not only had them go out in the garden once in a while, but they actually lived in remarkably beautiful and rich natural places, do you think that would have any effect on something as serious as schizophrenia?
Oh yeah. I don't think it would necessarily cure it, but there is some research evidence actually that in cultures that do something like that, where they don't put schizophrenic people in hospitals, but they do keep them at home, but they provide some kind of support services so they can stay at home. And if there's a lot of nature around, then they do better. Their symptoms are less florid. They're less unhappy. But as far as actually studying the nature piece in particular, I don't know of anything being done on that yet, but it's been done for a whole bunch of other things. So I'd be surprised if it didn't improve things. When you think about it, you know, the fact that we are part of nature and that we've just forgotten it, you know, because of the way you were talking about earlier, the way we live. But when we're reminded of that and we actually do something about it, it makes a big change. So if I was still doing therapy, for instance, I would, and I teach my students this, I teach psychotherapists in addition to other people at school, and I sometimes tell them, when you're doing couples therapy, ask, especially couples that fight a lot. The very first couple I ever saw when I was a trainee came in, and they couldn't agree on why they were there. And they got into a fight right in front of me, and I said, here it is. Here we go. So eventually they did. So with couples who fight a lot, ask them, where do you fight? Do you fight in a little room, like a bedroom or, you know, some small space? And if you do, the next time you have a difficult conversation, go outside. If you live in a place where it's safe to, or you live near a park or the beach or whatever, go outside and see if it's a different conversation. And it often is. We forget the psychological effect of buildings, for instance, how they can press on us and our emotions and compact things. Whereas if you go outside and have a conversation, it's different. So when I have to do that at work, the campus I work on is beautiful, like a lot of places around here. So oftentimes if I have to have a tough conversation with somebody, I say, let's take a walk. And we go out and do that.
So following that, I've often wondered if I was crazy, because I feel like when I'm when we're all inside a lot, it kind of limits our imagination and presses on us. Yeah. And I'm wondering if I'm just hyper-suggestible and delusional, or if that's really true, that having a roof over our heads limits our consciousness.
I think that's that can be true. In my experience, there's a range of, what's a good way of saying this? I think some people are better with it than others. Like, for instance, some people are just city people, and they love cities, and they love living in all the action and the noise and all that, and other people can't tolerate any of that, and they have to live out in rural areas, and people like me are kind of in the middle somewhere, but I think it's different with different people, but in general, I think that's true. One of the reasons, by the way, the ancient Romans built buildings the way that they are structured is so that one commander could dominate many men at one time when he was whipping them up for battle, so he could impose his will on a lot of different people. And so that's one of the reasons that some buildings, anyway, are shaped in such, long narrow buildings so that one speaker can just dominate the room. So that might be part of what you're talking about.
As you talk, things just keep coming up. I'm not going to monopolize the entire conversation, but I'm going to monopolize it for a little while longer. What about contact with animals?
Yes.
Does that make any difference in how we feel?
Oh, yeah. Has anybody seen videos of this or news stories or? A couple.
I've pet therapy. Continuing to go to the hospitals and see kids and stuff.
Yep.
To me, there's nothing better than a dog.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That would be an example. Also, people who've been through different kinds of trauma and a really wide range of it. So, people who've been sexually assaulted, combat veterans, all kinds of things. Horrible things that people have been through. If they're around animals, especially in settings where the person managing the animals knows what they're doing, the relief that can bring is amazing. And if any of you surf to YouTube, there's a lot of videos on specifically on combat vets around horses. And they don't ride them, but they just hang out with them. And the amazing effect of that. And it's so moving to hear the vets talk about the effect that has on their self-esteem and how they feel better about who they are. It's amazing. So the technical term for that is animal-assisted therapy, but in a way it builds on the intuition that a lot of us have had down the millennia that being around animals, for at least some of us, is healthy. It's good.
So on the other end of the spectrum from schizophrenics, the question is, if high-functioning people go out in nature more, especially in inspiring nature, does that open the possibility for higher states of consciousness?
Oh yeah, there's traditions all over the world that link spirituality with being out in nature. And if you think about the stories of really famous enlightened people, from the Buddha to Jesus to Muhammad to whoever it is that you're talking about in all different traditions, there's always a strong nature connection. The metaphors of Jesus about vines and branches and him being outside all the time, and the image of the tree, for instance, the Buddha was said to obtain enlightenment sitting under the Bodhi tree. Muhammad prayed in a cave and received the Quran that way, according to Islamic tradition. So that nature is a prominent part of all of these stories of how people attain enlightenment in mystical states. And keep in mind, too, that in older societies, there wasn't such a split between the natural world and the human world. They were more interlinked. And so when John of the Cross talks about how contact with higher states, as we would call them, can feel like the impurities inside of you are being burned away like green wood being burned in a fire, that the images are nature images oftentimes, because people didn't split nature and culture as much as we do now. So many traditions, it's not really a field, but there's a whole, contemporary approach is a good way to call it, in eco-spirituality, and we look at all these traditions and practice it. So, yeah. ceremonial work too. Powerful stuff.
So there's an excuse for those of you who are crazy nature lovers like me. When I'm going out there, when I should be doing something else, I'm actually doing very valuable work for my psyche.
Yeah. And some people would say, and for the world. Yeah.
So now I want to, Abraham, and then I'm going to switch gears. Abraham, so loud.
Do you want me to talk?
Yeah, you had a question.
You know, every time I think, if I get depressed, I think of what Thomas Paine said about nature. He said that men and books lie. Nature never lies. And when I get out there and try to, you know, get rid of my depression, I look at the trees, I look at the grass around. At night, I look at the night skies, the stars, and I get home, and my depression subsided. And there is, I'm so surprised that you, when the psychologist that you saw said that you're depressed and gave you some medicine and took you to the other doctor, I was surprised that you accepted that for a year. And you have told us, you know, how connected you are to nature. So, what was going on in your mind in that year?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. You want me to answer that?
Or? Yeah.
Was that rhetorical, or do you want me to answer it? Actually, I'd like to, because I may get nervous on it. Yeah.
Yes, I want to answer.
Sometimes when you're in a training program, you really immerse yourself in the worldview of that training program. And so I had all these role models who were therapist teachers to emulate, and it never came up for them. And I think I was just I had come out of a period of my life where, like a lot of us, I was so fascinated by what we can build and technology and all the rest of it, and just so busy, you know, with studies and work and everything, that like a lot of us, I actually forgot about the presence of the natural world and had to be reminded of it. And when I finally was, I was talking to my dad about it, and I said, yeah, and I'm gardening and, you know, blissful states and this and that and this, and he said, I get going for that.
So I kind of want to switch now, okay? What I'm switching to, and I'm not quite sure how we're going to get into this, but I'll ask a stupid question that always helps. The stupid question is myth.
Yeah.
I mean, let's talk a little bit of myth. Isn't that just what you tell kids? I mean, isn't that like fairy tales? What relevance does that have?
Yeah, good. And we can use the umbrella term folklore to talk about all of that. So myth, fairy tale, folktale, legend, fables, all of that is folklore, you know. But myth in particular, in our society, right, it means lie, pretty much. People go, oh, that's a myth, you know, and they mean it's not true, right? But if you think about where myth originates as a sacred story, where when people telling myths, as we call them, it's our society that calls them myths, right? That's in European society. But there's a mythologist named Joseph Campbell who used to joke that we use the word myth for other people's religion. Not ours, but other people's religion. So he had a point there. So if you think of it as sacred stories, right? And the stories are stories that people have told as long as there have been people. Some scholars and others maintain that one of the ways we became human beings was we sat by rivers and in front of fires, and we told ourselves that this is where the stars come from, and this is how things come into being, and this is why we're here. And so one of the things that has come out of all of that is that the stories, they're not only entertaining, which is why they last for a millennia, and they evolve. They don't stay the same. There's no original myth. There's no such thing. They all change through time. But the stories have wisdom that is available to those of us if we can get past the literal level of the myth and think of it metaphorically or symbolically and listen in for the wisdom there. So as an example, there's a lot of myths and folk tales and fairy tales that warn us not to get out of balance with the natural world, and that bad things happen when we do. So for instance, there's a Korean story about, my colleagues hate it when I tell this story because a lot of them just want to work psychologically and they don't really, that's where they're comfortable. And I love psychological work, or I wouldn't be a death psychologist, but I think we have to do more than that sometimes. And so this story cautions about that, I think. So there was a kingdom, according to this old myth, there was a kingdom with a king who was a good man, not terribly insightful, but not a bad leader. And for wisdom, he had, you could call him a priest or an oracle or whatever. Korean culture, by the way, when you go far back enough, is very open to all of these states. A lot of cultures are indigenous cultures. And so what started to happen was different spirits of the natural world began showing up in front of the palace. And they would do these dances that had these big names, big titles. And the king would see the nature spirits dance, and then the people would turn out and they'd watch the nature spirits. The wind spirit would come and dance, and then the earth spirit would come and dance, and all that. And they would say, wow, look at all this action. Look at these amazing things happening. But unfortunately, this kingdom was such that people forgot what the names of the dances mean. And the dances were warnings. Because the kingdom was getting out of balance. The people in the kingdom were thinking of the world as only theirs, that they own the world. They were neglecting all the other creatures that live in the world. And so the nature spirits showed up to warn them. So the king would ask the oracle, what does this dance mean? And the oracle was just as ignorant as everybody else, and so he would make it up. You know? Oh, it means, a fantastic pageantry for a wonderful king. The king would go, oh, great. So the king would say, let's build a pavilion. And so they would, they would build something to commemorate the nature spirit. So they had pavilions all over the place after a while. So on the last day of the kingdom, on the last day, the mountain spirit came down and did a very complex dance and went away. And unfortunately for the kingdom, nobody, the king of horses had his usual reaction, right? Wow, what a great dance, and let's build a pavilion. And they started working on a pavilion to honor the mountain spirit. What they didn't know, though, was the name of the dance was He Who Rules Wisely Understands the Signs and Tells the People to Flee in Great Numbers. And that was the last day of the kingdom. So there's a lot in myth, not just warnings, too, it's not all accounting, but there's a lot of joyfulness about nature, too. There's lots of stories. You see this in folklore and fairy tales, too, where somebody gets stuck and they don't know really what to do, and then the ant people come up or the bird people come up or whatever, and they say, oh, just do this, or we'll do it for you. Our word psyche, as in psychology, comes from an old story about a young woman named Psyche who got in a situation like that. And she didn't know what to do, and the eagles and the ants and other people in nature showed up and did the tasks for her. So part of Psyche's education on the level of metaphor is to realize that we have something to learn from the natural world. And let me ask too, before we go to the next piece, has anyone in here heard the word biomimicry?
Yes.
Ah, good.
Sure.
What is it?
It's innovating, inspired by the processes of nature.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Biomimicry. So, for instance, how is it that this biomimicry designers, they come from many different fields, engineering and physics and chemistry and other fields, biology, they ask themselves questions like this. How is it that termites build a mound that withstands a major earthquake? We can't do that. But we can learn how to if we look at the design principles involved. And it withstands a major earthquake, but it also cools and heats itself. How do they do that? How does a spider weave such a strong web with no blast furnace to make metal? So when we look at nature as a mentor, we learn amazing things. And so some of these nature myths and folktales tell us that. And they're thousands of years old, but they say there's a lot of teachers in the natural world. And if we learn from their example, we can do amazing things too. But we have to have the humility to learn.
So, I'm kind of confused, okay? So these myths that have meaning, powerful meaning, where do they come from? Do they come from inside us? Do they come from nature? I mean, how come is it that these things are so meaningful?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is kind of what psychology would say, especially Jungian psychology, the psychology of Carl Jung. I used to think they just came from us.
Is it?
Oh, no, I'm just saying, can I ask a question at some point?
Yes, you can, yes.
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
I used to think they just came from us, like, you know, there was an inspiration or a dream or something like that. And so somebody, you know, sitting around a fire says, I have this amazing dream, and then they tell it. And it resonates with a lot of different people, so then those people start telling the dream, and that resonates with more people, and then eventually ceremonies get built around it, and then institutions get built around it, and so on. And there's some truth in that. But over the years of reconnecting with the natural world, I've started to wonder whether it's actually a conversation that's not just internal, although a big part of it is, but whether we're actually in continual conversation with the places where we live, the places where we work, and whether mythology actually, meaning sacred stories, comes from not only inside of us, but the space between us and nature. And so as a direct example, possibly of this, I was at spending the night at some springs years ago, some hot springs, and I had a dream. I was curious about the place, and when I went to bed, I was thinking about, I wonder what's here, And so I had a dream that the spirits of that land, the spirits of that place, were teaching me a new way to meditate. And I woke up not remembering what they had told me, but sometimes I think a dream doesn't depend on whether we remember it or not. It still works on us at some level. And maybe the dream is its own message. In cases like that, it doesn't need to be interpreted. But it made me curious about whether a lot of our spiritual practices actually originate that way. Maybe people used to know how to listen to the land better, and it would teach them how to pray or meditate or what have you. So I've come to think, because of that myths, sacred stories, are actually perhaps a conversation between us and the world.
So that implies that there is consciousness out there that is trying to tell us something.
Yeah, it does. And I don't know that that could be looked at through a microscope, but the more we learn about the natural world, the more incredible it becomes, the more fantastically intelligent and intricate it becomes. We only learned about 5 or 6 years ago that if you look at some of the trees that are around us here, if you were to cover one of those so that the leaves couldn't photosynthesize, the wonderful soil fungi in the ground, those networks of filaments, mycelium, is aware of if it stretches far enough, and sometimes it stretches across big parts of a continent, so it's all interconnected, kind of like our brain cells are. So the networks here have become aware that there's a tree in danger, and we've actually been able to see those networks in the soil funneling extra nutrients to keep that tree alive. So soil fungi has the intelligence to manage an ecosystem that way. So that's one example of countless. There's also trans-species research being done on how other species communicate with each other. And we know things like that dolphin languages have dialects, for instance, and that here in California, sometimes, I was going to say ravens, but I think I mean crows, they would grab a nut that had a hard casing on the outside of it, and they would drop it on pavement in order to open it so they could get the good stuff on the inside. But they quickly realized that's dangerous in traffic. So they looked at the lights at intersections, and they realized that when the light's green and people are walking, that's safe. So they coordinated, right? Elephants would come back to where loved ones have perished and they mourn. They lower their ears and their tails, and they show all the signs of mourning. Other species do that too. So we're living in a much more intelligent world than perhaps our kind of mechanistic worldview allowed us to appreciate. So
I'm kind of getting to there, but there's one I want to follow that comment. Depth psychology would say that we're living in a much more intelligent mind than we know about.
Yes.
So could you say something about the levels that are underneath or above the level that we hang out in?
Isn't it amazing how when we do work on ourselves, for instance, and our filters start dropping away and we disidentify with things that are no longer helpful, we see the world differently. So as our vision changes, things that we formerly didn't notice become apparent to us out in nature as well. So, you know, to refer to Carl Jung in this conversation a little bit, he talked about how if you explore yourself on your own in therapy, what have you, through spiritual practices, you move down through the layers of the personal psyche into what he called the collective unconscious. And you begin discovering these powerful cosmic images and archetypes. And he called some of them God images, and deity images, and things like that, spiritual experiences. And so if you keep going, he wrote in some of his later writings that ultimately you're down to the level of the world. So in the collective unconscious, according to Jung, there's a layer of the psyche in which we're all connected, all of us as humans. And he felt that it applied to animals too. And so we've taken his work a little bit farther in the direction he himself was going toward the end of his life. And we look at things like synchronistic experiences, you know, meaningful coincidences that seem to indicate things are connected. And it looks like this is a quality of the world rather than just something that's inside of us. So the deeper we go inside ourselves, the deeper we go down into the intelligence of the world as well, it looks like.
Okay, so I just want to, say what I think I heard, and then I want you to kind of verify it, and then Robert can get to your question. Because many of you probably heard the term world unconscious, and that's not something we learned in school, most of us. Yeah. So is what you're saying that if we go deeper in ourselves, we find our personal past, and then if we go deeper than that, we find the patterns that we have evolved that we all share?
Yeah.
Then if we go deeper than that, we find a connection to other species. And if we go deeper than that, we find a connection to somehow the whole planet?
Yeah.
That our intelligence comes at the base from a larger planetary intelligence?
Yeah, according to this way of looking at it, yeah. Yep. There's an exercise that we don't have time to do it in here, but I suggest doing it. Well, maybe not on your own. It's fun to do in groups, actually. I do it when I teach sometimes outside. It's good to teach eco-psych outside as well as inside. But try this when you're outside sometime. Go outside and lay down on the grass or just someplace where you're comfortable. And there's a little bit of perhaps hypnosis involved in this, but for the most part, it's guided imagery. And watch, like we were doing earlier, watch your thoughts until you get in kind of a space of reverie. And then imagine that your consciousness is kind of this, maybe a blue fluid or a green fluid or something like that. And as you're laying on the earth, imagine it leaking down into the soil. And follow it in your imagination. So you go down into the soil and you see the different things that are down there, the creatures that are making soil happen and all of that. And then down through the bedrock and keep going. And then let it spread as you do this meditative exercise. And eventually, keep going until you get to the point, maybe 20, 25 minutes later, if you haven't fallen asleep, because that happens sometimes when you do this stuff. You get to the point where the whole world is held in your imagination. When students have done this, they say they can feel the intelligence of the earth. So try it for yourself and see what happens. One other thing to try out about this. When I teach eco-psychology, we work a lot with dreams and how they connect us to the natural world. So I'll often tell students about something called dream incubation, which is kind of a fancy term for just asking for a dream. So when you go to sleep at night, when you're in kind of that sleep zone place where you're starting to get tired, if you ask what you think of as your unconscious or the back of your mind or whatever, for a dream about something, oftentimes you'll have one. It may not come right away. It may come a few days later, or it may even show up in another person. So when I used to do therapy, if somebody came in and said, I don't drink much, I would say something like, well, ask your partner or your brother or your family member or somebody if they've started dreaming a lot more lately. Because those are probably your dreams landing in them. It happens all the time. Right? That's how connected we are, right? So if you're working on something difficult or facing a decision, you can incubate a dream. That's the usual psychological way of doing it. So this takes it a step further. So see what happens if you form a mental picture in your imagination of the entire planet floating in space and ask it for a dream. And see what happens. My students have had remarkable experiences, and sometimes nothing happens. But see if something shows up.
So Robert, you wanted to ask.
I was wondering if you have a particular vision of the future, and in particular, how do you balance this desire to be connected to nature with the desire to the fact that we can create wonderful things like we see in Star Trek. What is your vision of the future?
Big question. I try to be kind of modest about it, but in terms of the way my mind works, sometimes if I'm not having a wild flight of fancy, I try to imagine things that are doable. Don't let that limit you, though. Imagine all kinds of things. I mean, in imagination, there's no rules. You can do anything you want, right? But if I try to think about where could we go, you know, I often see something like I think at this point we need to be a planetary civilization because we are whether we want to be or not. We've done that a couple of times, spread out over the whole globe. So, but something grown from the ground up, something locally rooted, and of course I'm a big democracy fan, so something democratic and earth-honoring and able to integrate technology into our relationship with the natural world. Biomimicry is one of many ways of doing that. I think permaculture is a technology in some ways, so that we can do both. And there's a statement when I think about that question that comes to mind sometimes when we're on this topic, and it came from H.G. Wells. He's known in this country mainly as a science fiction writer. He wrote The War of the Worlds and The Time Machine and a bunch of other classical science fiction books. But in Europe, he was also known as a futurist and a culture critic and a historian and a number of other things. And so toward the end of his life, he was asked that famous question, you know, how to put this into an elevator speech, right? Who are you? Which is a good question to ask yourself as an exercise. Who am I in a couple of sentences, right? And he had the most interesting answer. He said, I'm English by origin, but I am new world man, in capital letters, new world man. And I live in exile from the world community of my desire. And then he said, I salute that finer, higher civilization from across the generations, and perhaps someone down the vista will appreciate an ancestral salutation. So that's what comes to mind. And I have faith that we can build something like that. We've done remarkable things as a species. We survived thousands of years ago an ecological disaster that wiped out most of the life on this planet, and we came back from that. So, you know, we can do incredible things if we're really serious about it.
Right, so I'm gonna ask one more, and then I'll throw it open, okay? Which is, going from the sublime to the ridiculous. if we are motivated down deep by these patterns that we are to animate us, then whatever we do should be a manifestation of these deeper motivations. So that would mean that myths are being played out in our current reality, in our everyday actions, but in what's happening in the world. Can you give us an example of how a myth that is deep in humanity is being played out in a particular way in something that's happening in the world?
Can I give two examples?
By the way, I want to say that this is, this kind of lens, to have this kind of lens, is unbelievably powerful.
Yes.
Because you see what's really happening, not just the headline. So go for it.
Part of when we say death psychology, DPTH, sometimes when I say that, people say death psychology? Well, I guess that's part of it. But death, so one of the meanings of death is to see the images and symbols underneath the current event, right? The themes and symbols that are actually playing out, because that tells you where the psyche is, collectively as well as personally. So one example that I did a presentation to some graduates from the Columbia School of Business, and they were interested in the relationship between mythology and business. And so one of the things I gave them was an opinion, which was that the language of finance, for the most part, makes it sound objective. And there's a lot of analysis that goes into it, and I'm not a financial expert, but I know people who are. The more I learn about it, the more I appreciate how much incredible mind power goes into the whole financial world, you know. And standing right next to that is this huge vocabulary of mythical terms. So from unicorns to angel investors to there's all kinds of mood terms also, right? You can be recessed, depressed, and so on and so forth. Then you have to go see your financial analyst. There's a wishing hour, castles in the air, blue sky, invisible hand. You know, it's right out of religious history. And so it's almost as though the mythical world is coming back right where we least expect it to, and right where we feel we're being objective. Right.
I got a question.
Wait, not yet.
So another example that's related to this one is when I taught in the Bay Area. I was up there at the time when Apple phones started to get really big. And so people were doing the all-night camping out the way they used to when I was growing up, and they would go watch Star Wars, and they would camp out all night at the first show, you know. And so people were doing this for phone upgrades. Not even for the very first phone, but just for an upgrade. And which, you know, the new phone would look almost exactly like the old phone, but it could do different things, right? So there were people that would sneer at that and go, oh, they need to get life, and, you know, don't they ever work, or whatever. But as a deaf psychologist, I got curious about it. I thought, there's something really powerful here. As thousands of people are doing this. It must mean something, you know? So I'd have conversations with them. And what I gradually realized was that these devices are, as far as the unconscious goes anyway, are magical objects. This is the return of magic. And so a phone isn't just a phone, it's a magic wand. You can do things on a phone that Merlin couldn't do with his own magic wand. Right? And so, and a tablet is it's a scribing tool. It's, you look into it and you see all kinds of things, you know. So in many ways, the myth that we deny conscious access to shows up in our devices, it shows up in our economies, all kinds of different places. So myth is happening all the time, whether we realize it or not. And when we do realize it, we can have a different relationship to it. So that it doesn't act on us compulsively and make us do things.
Wait, not quite yet, Julie. So I want to ask one more, follow that one more time, and this is a hard one, which is, does myth also show up in political events?
All the time, sure. How often do you hear about the archetype of the Golden Age? Right? If we could just go back to the 19 whatever, you know, when everything was great except for this group of people.
Yes.
You know, the good old days, yeah. The people who live outside even have a different view, you know. But so that shows up a lot too, the archetype of the Golden Age. There are mythic stories in most cultures about how when a society is not governed intelligently and compassionately, then whatever that culture uses for their version of the heavens or the other world or what have you, the giants come and they begin tearing the whole world down. And that tells people we have to get serious about government ourselves. So there's lots of stories about how the Titans or the Frost Giants or the Asuras or whatever the big demonic figures are called, they visit the society and they begin tearing all the structures down. And so at that point, somebody needs to go, uh-oh, we have to do something really different. And so in a way, these fearsome demonic gigantic forces are like threshold guardians. You know those old stories where somebody's on a path of danger, like a heroic path, and they have to go through a certain doorway, and there's these fearsome beings that are waiting for them. And you have to know how to get past the demons, right? They're there to test you. They're there to figure out if you actually have what it takes to move forward. And so when I think about, you know, very destructive political forces, I often hold them as threshold guardians that we have to understand and somehow move beyond in order to go forward as a people. There's a beautiful piece of, originally it's an oral chant and it's still used that way in some circles, but it's from one of the Navajo ceremonies, and it's about a character who has been revived in Navajo circles several times actually, and his name is Monster Slayer, and he's one of their hero figures. He's like Hercules or Gilgamesh or one of the Finn McCool for the Irish, you know, one of the big heroic characters. And Monster Slayer, Nan Ascani, clears the land of beasts, of monsters, so people can live safely. And so in this chant, it's the hero figure is going into the underworld to get initiated. And it says something like, at the door of Darkness Mountain, there were two red boot owls with their heads reversed. In other words, they're fearsome, monstrous, unnatural beings. Nyan Ascani parts them with his dark staff and comes in search of me. And then it goes deeper in, you know. So there's a lot of stories about that as well. How to get initiated, how to deal with monsters.
So if I, wait 1 second. Not in 1 second. So to reiterate what you said and put it in other words, some of the political happenings now can be looked at as tests of our resolve to go forward and create something better.
Yeah. So monsters and tricksters. Is anyone familiar with that term trickster?
Yeah.
So if you read mythology and talk to people about it from different cultures, the tricksters are understood to be dangerous. They're not all as clownish figures. They can be. They can be comics and funny and all that stuff, but they're amoral, right? And so the tricksters show up when a situation of injustice has continued for a really long time and it needs to be shaken up. And so that's when trickster comes and he stirs the pot big time. And the almost universal academic description of trickster is agent of chaos. So when the trickster shows up, you know that something's been let go for a really long time, and now the party starts.
Are they orange?
So I have a story about that.
Okay, so wait, 1 second, we're getting there. So what he just said is there's a way to look at certain things that are happening right now, maybe in this country and this world, that couches them in a different light, okay? And respects their place in a transformational process, okay? Okay, Julie.
I get depressed sometimes.
Yeah.
Because I'm isolated, I'm depressed, and I'm lonely, and all that. And I like to look forward to.
Mm-hmm. Those are the times when I go outside and be around animals, if there's any out there, and plants, and trees, and green things, and let them take care of me a little bit.
That's good. They're always there.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't depend on people. There are always animals and plants.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see. Let's go around. We'll start here, and then we'll go with Michael, and then Michael.
In terms of this eco-psychology, are you aware of any studies that have been done on prolonged stay in space, like in the International Space Station?
No,
being apart from Earth, but very aware of its globalness?
I wonder about that. Not that I'm aware of, but that's one of the things that I have a concern about with things like Star Trek. You know, there's such a technological emphasis, but what about our need for nature? You know? So, no, none that I'm aware of. That'd be interesting to know about, though.
Because I have a very, very adventurous and all, but the idea of being in a space where, you know, within seconds I could explode.
Yeah.
Or I love scuba diving, but the idea of going so deep where I can just be crushed in seconds if things are not proper, it's a deterrent. It's a turnoff.
There's a science fiction author that I actually got to meet when I lectured in Hong Kong a couple of months ago, and there's three universities pulled together at a conference, and so he was there as one of the lecturers. I was there, and a bunch of other people, Ken Stanley Robinson. And he wrote a remarkable novel called Aurora, and I'm about to give the whole plot away. Well, not actually not the whole plot, but a key part of it. So plug your ears if you're going to read it. Major spoiler. It's about an interstellar voyage of colonization. And what they find when they arrive is that all the robots they sent out to look at whether planets were suitable to live on missed some significant ecological factors. For instance, the amount of sunlight and the absence of sunlight, the necessity for a certain rhythm for plants to grow. So none of their plants would grow on the planet they picked because they didn't study them. You know, they knew it scientifically, but they didn't think about what it meant to on the ecological level. There was a prion, a certain kind of protein that was in the soil that was poisonous to human beings. So all the colonists, here's the spoiler, so close your ears. They all say, you know, there was no way to know this. We didn't look. Our forebears, rather, didn't ask the right questions. Now we're stuck out here in the middle of nowhere. We can't make a living here. We better go home. And the whole mission spends centuries coming back to Earth, and then their descendants reach the Earth. You know, but it's an incredible novel. And so when I talked to him about this, I asked him, why'd you write a novel like that? It's so different from Star Trek. You know? And he said, because I think life is planetary. There might be forms of life that exist between planets, and then they have their own kind of ecosystem. But the kind of life that we think of as life is probably planetary. So it's an interesting idea, anyway. Some people like it, some people don't, but it's something to think about.
So I'll say one more thing. I'll add to that. On the International Space Station, there are windows. Okay, it's not like, and they made a cupola that's completely windows, and people spend as much time as possible up there and take photographs, like Terry Virts, some of you may have seen at UCSB. And so they're connecting with nature. They have to. You can't stay inside. You know, you can't stay inside. Okay, so Michael.
Part time. Where does our intelligence figure in?
And this is the first part of that.
Heart mind.
Heart mind.
How does heart intelligence figure into eco-psychology?
Many ways. One that comes to me immediately would be the response of the heart to nature. Actually, you were kind of going there with what you just said. There's a term that the astronauts use called the overview effect.
Yes.
And it refers to how somebody who's new up at the International Space Station looks out the window and they notice the beauty of the Earth for the very first time, and they're just wow, you know. And they sit there for hours, and someone has to, you know, work to do. So that's a response of the heart. In 1968, on Christmas Eve, Apollo 8 had three astronauts aboard, two of whom looked out the window, and they saw that famous picture that we've all seen of Earth rise. Yeah. But their first response wasn't scientific, it was aesthetic. It was a heart response. They went, wow, that's beautiful. And one of the astronauts, I forget which one, said, you got any color film? And then they took a picture of it. You know. I've talked to one colonel who was in charge of building the engines for that mission. He showed up at a presentation I gave in Arizona, and he told me about how when that image came back to Earth, the scientists and the engineers and everybody were just, wow. So that's where part of this is too. It's in that the awakening of emotional responsiveness to what's around us. Empathy for animals and appreciation of nature, things like that.
So there was one. Okay. We'll go here and then here. Okay. Two. Yeah.
There is a process called earthing, which is similar to what you were sharing, except you don't do any visualization.
Yeah.
But where you can stand with your bare feet or lie on the ground for maybe 20 minutes, and people have reported extraordinary healing of cancer and chronic back pain for many years, and, as well as emotional healing. It's just a very simple, very simple process.
That's what always amazes me about this, is that you don't have to fill out reams of paperwork, you don't have to go online and apply for something and have things taken out of your bank account and all the rest of it. You can just go. Yeah. And each culture has versions of that. So in Japan, they would call it forest bathing. And it just means going out in the forest, you know, and letting it in, you know.
I mean, I think it's inevitable. When you spend time in nature, it's,
yeah,
it's amazing.
There's a scholar named Thomas Berry, who, a scholar and also a Catholic priest, so he called himself a geologian. And they asked him, well, how did this start for you? And we all have nature stories about how we connected, you know. And so he mentions this meadow that he grew up near when he was a kid, and how his whole sense of values and ethics ultimately goes back to how he felt about that meadow and how much he loved it.
It may, to follow the thing about earthing, it may be that some of our difficulty has to do with the fact that we wear shoes all the time.
Yes.
And that we actually never contact the earth with our feet. So if there's an energy, it's blocked by the rubber.
That's more leather.
Or leather.
Leather is
the main. Okay. So, Morty, you're going to have the last question here.
How do you reconcile the fact that our species is a killing machine?
Yeah.
And that we willingly accept the fact of murder of the trees, the forest, I mean, the world, the planet, and the people in it, and the animals, and whatever breathe, whatever exists, it's just so irreconcilable. Last night I saw the Michael Moore film, Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just inconceivable that we permit what we do. It's just enough to make somebody just become depressed beyond any kind of
self-salvation. One of my colleagues, Linda Bazell, who is a classically trained psychotherapist and also an ecotherapist, was one of the people who came up with something that she refers to as stages of awakening. And it's deliberately based on Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work about the acceptance of death when somebody that you love is dying. And according to Linda Bazell and Sarah Edwards, when people first realize the extent of what we're doing destructively to the planet, there's this huge sense of shock. Like, how in the world did this happen? How can we let this happen? And then there's often depression and anger and sorrow and then helplessness. But eventually, if we keep going with all of that and stay sensitive, even though it's painful to, we get to the point of saying, what do I personally feel called to do? Even though it may just be some small thing, but a lot of small things add up, right? How do I feel called into action somehow? Can I mentor somebody? Can I care for somebody who's an activist or whatever it is? I often think, this is one of the reasons I love fantasy. There's so much wisdom in fantasy too. And myth is a kind of fantasy in a way. And so there's a scene that appears in the film The Hobbit that doesn't appear in the book, but does appear in the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien. And it's the scene where the wizard Gandalf is talking to the wise woman Galadriel, who's kind of a goddess figure. She looks like the goddess of many different cultures, Sophia, in other words. And Gandalf has just told Bilbo Baggins, who's about this tall, and doesn't want adventures. He hates adventures. He's a stay-at-home guy. And Gandalf says, you need to join this band of dwarves and go out and fight a dragon. And Bilbo said, are you kidding? And then he finally got pushed into it, you know. So Galadriel asks Gandalf, why Bilbo? What, you know, the little guy who wants to stay at home all the time, why did you pick him for this adventure? And I love Tolkien's, and actually where it comes from, I love his answer. He says, well, naming the head of the wizard order, Saruman, who becomes corrupt, he says, Saruman believes that only great power can keep evil in check, but that is not what I found. I found it is the small things, the ordinary deeds of everyday folk that keep the darkness at bay. Simple acts of kindness and love. And then he says, why Bilbo? Because I'm afraid and he gives me courage. And sure enough, he wins. So Tolkien reminded some of his readers of that, that he would get criticized sometimes for how the plot was set up. And he'd say, did you not notice that it wasn't the powerful wizards, it wasn't the huge armies that saved Middle-earth, it was two little hobbits who just cared for each other and wanted to go home.
So on that note, which is a wonderful note to have,